All right. The last time we were talking about Mendelian genetics, and what you see on slide 8 is the results of a Mendelian monohybrid cross, like we already talked about. This one happens to be flower color as the characteristic under study, but the same kind of ratio, the same ratios would apply no matter what characteristic you're talking about if it's a Mendelian monohybrid cross. We already talked about the 3-to-1 ratio, right? That's called a phenotypic ratio because it's a ratio of one phenotype to the other phenotype. On the other side, though, you see what is called a genotypic ratio, the ratio in genotypes. And that doesn't just have two numbers, it has three. It's a 1-to-2-to-1 ratio of genotypes in the F2 generation. And the reason for this is because the way dominance and recessivity works is that it only takes one dominant allele to produce the dominant phenotype. And there's two different genotypes that have at least one dominant allele in them, right? So homozygous is one genotype, uppercase, uppercase. There's also heterozygous genotype, though, uppercase, lowercase. A heterogeneous individual is going to have exactly the same phenotype because of dominance as a homozygous dominant individual. But the genotypes are different. This is a heterozygous genotype, that's a homozygous one. So it's 1-to-2-to-1, and that final one is the homozygous recessive genotype, which of course corresponds to the recessive trait. That's the only way in complete dominance, if you have complete dominance, the only way that you can have the recessive trait is for your genotype to be homozygous recessive, right? Because if you have just one or more dominant alleles, you're not going to have the recessive trait, you're going to have the dominant trait. All right, that explains the ratios. Slide 9 shows you some more Punnett squares, which we've already talked about, but this is used a little bit differently. What's being done here is a different kind of cross. This is called a test cross. And test crosses are done if you want to know what the genotype is of an individual that has the dominant phenotype. So let me explain why that is a question. If you look at an organism, you can tell just by looking at it whether it has the dominant trait or dominant phenotype or the recessive phenotype, right? If it has purple colors, it's dominant. If it has purple flowers, it's dominant in the flower example. If it has white flowers, it's recessive phenotype. Okay? So you know the phenotype just by looking at it, because phenotype is what you observe, actually. Well, if you notice that it's the recessive phenotype, you see that it's white flower, you not only know the phenotype, but you know the genotype, because of what I just said in the last slide. There's only one possible genotype that can give you that recessive phenotype, right? So if I look at a pea plant and see that it has white flowers, I not only know that it's white flowered, which is the phenotype, I also know that it's lowercase, lowercase in its genotype, right? But if I look at a purple flowered one, I know that it's dominant phenotype just by looking at it, but I don't know what the genotype is, because it could be homozygous dominant, uppercase, uppercase, or it could be heterozygous, uppercase, lowercase. Either one of those two genotypes gives the same phenotype. Well, sometimes it's desirable to actually know the genotype, not just the phenotype. For instance, if you're trying to raise these things for profit, you want to have true breeding individuals, which would be homozygous dominant, not a heterozygous individual. Because if you breed heterozygous ones, then you'll sometimes get recessive offspring, right? So sometimes you would like to know what the genotype is of a dominant individual. And to do that, you perform what is called a test cross. What you do is, think of it as an either-or proposition. Okay? The question is the individual that has the dominant phenotype homozygous dominant in its genotype, or is it heterozygous? Those are the only two possibilities. That's the question here. Uppercase, uppercase, or uppercase, lowercase. One of those two is true, but only one of them. The way you answer it is by imagining mating that individual, which is either upper, upper, or upper, lower, with a recessive individual, which is lower, lower. Okay? By imagining mating them, you can come up with two Punnett squares. The two Punnett squares shown here. One Punnett square is what you would get if the purple one is uppercase, uppercase. The other one is what you'd get if the purple one is uppercase, lowercase. Right? So only one of these Punnett squares is really true, but it tells you what the prediction of the offspring would be in each of the two cases. So, if we have a homozygous dominant purple-flowered one and you mate it with the white-flowered one, you would get 100% of the offspring purple, because every offspring would have at least one uppercase P from that purple-flowered individual, since it only has uppercase P's to give, right? And it only takes one to make it a purple-flowered individual. So that's, you would get, it would be impossible to get any white individuals if it were true that this one you're worried about is actually homozygous dominant, upper, upper. On the other hand, if it's upper, lower, if it's a heterozygous purple flowered one and you mate it with a white one, you would expect half of the offspring to be purple and half of them to be white because of the Punnett square. Okay, so that the Punnett squares give the predictions. Then you actually go ahead and do the mating. And you look at the offspring, the real offspring, and whichever Punnett square the real offspring match up with, that tells you that Punnett square is correct. Yeah?
On the square, does it matter where you put the genotype?
No, you could put eggs on top and sperm to the left, or vice versa. It would change the position of them, but it wouldn't change the ratios.
Oh.
So if you actually did this cross, and let's say you got a bunch of offspring, even if only one of them was white, just by low probability luck, that would still say this is the correct Punnett square, because white is impossible under this scenario. So that would tell you that the one you're worried about, the purple one, must be heterozygous. On the other hand, if you get 100% of the offspring are purple, chances are very good that it's this one that's true. It could, strictly speaking, happen here just by chance. But the more offspring you have, the lower that chance is that every one of them would be purple. So that's what a test cross is for. In slide 10, we have a different kind of cross again. The original cross we talked about last time was called a monohybrid cross, remember? Mono meaning one, because we only paid attention to one characteristic. Flower color, for instance, or any of the other six things that Mendel did in his monohybrid crosses. But it's also possible to do a dihybrid cross. And di means two. So a dihybrid cross is a cross between two parents that differ in the traits that you're... the traits of the characteristics you're talking about, but in a dihybrid cross, it's two characteristics that you're taking into account at the same time. So in this example, what are the two characteristics that are being followed in this dihybrid cross?
Color and wrinkled or not wrinkled.
Right, seed color and seed texture. Those are the two characteristics. But each characteristic has two traits. Right? So for seed color, it can be either yellow or green. For seed texture, it can be either smooth or wrinkled. And you could do monohybrid crosses for each of these two characteristics and only pay attention to that one characteristic. But you can also do a single cross and pay attention to both characteristics at the same time. That's a dihybrid cross. Well, a dihybrid cross is going to give you a bigger Punnett square because there's more possible combinations. So that's why it's a 4x4 Punnett square instead of a 2x2. And that's simply because, well, I'll explain that in a second. But look at the genotypes of these individuals. Notice that the genotypes contain two different kinds of symbols. Each kind of symbol has two in it to show that it's diploid. But the Ys correspond to the color gene. The Rs correspond to the texture gene. And so the fact that we're using Y for color means that yellow is dominant to green. Otherwise, we'd use a G, right? Uppercase Y means that it is the yellow allele. Lowercase Y means it's the green allele. The reason we're using R is because round, or smooth, is dominant over wrinkled. Otherwise, we'd be using a W. So uppercase R means that it is actually round. Lowercase R means it's wrinkled. And the picture, notice, corresponds to each genotype. Upper Y, upper R means true breeding yellow and true breeding round. Well, that P is yellow and round. Lower Y, lower R is true breeding green and true breeding wrinkled, which is exactly what that is. When you get the two together, it's very similar to a monohybrid cross. Every one of the F1 individuals is going to be heterozygous. But in this case, it's going to be doubly heterozygous because it's going to be heterozygous for the one characteristic and heterozygous for the other one. That's why every one of these F1 offspring, or everyone in the F1 generation, is going to be upper lower. Heterozygous for color and heterozygous for texture. But because it's complete dominance in both, that means this one uppercase Y is enough to make it fully yellow and this one uppercase R is enough to make it fully round. So every one of the F1s is yellow and round, just like one of the parents. And if you were to interbreed these, just like you did in a monohybrid cross, to produce the F2 generation, then you have this Punnett square on the right. And I'm not going to get into dependent assortment and independent assortment, so don't worry about that. But this Punnett square on the right shows you a dihybrid cross is Punnett square. And if you think about this cross, you would list this cross, since it's F1 crossed with another F1, what you really have is upper lower crossed with another upper lower, right? That's what's happening with F1 crossed with another F1 to produce the F2. So these genotypes, each single letter represents an allele, which is one of the two genes, right? You have two chromosomes. Each chromosome has a gene on it. So this is on one chromosome, this is on the other. This is on one chromosome, this is on the other. When an organism produces gametes, either eggs or sperm, it randomly chooses one of the alleles of the two. So when you have a dihybrid cross where you're paying attention to two characteristics, there's four different gametes this thing can make. It can choose this Y and this R, this Y and this R, this Y and this R, and this Y and this R. In other words, the gametes possible are upper Y, upper R, upper Y, lower R, lower Y, upper R, lower Y, lower R. Which is exactly what's listed on the side and to the top. Those are the four kinds of gametes each parent is able to make. Therefore, when you get these things together to make the zygotes, you have all four possibilities, all four possible combinations of traits. You have yellow round possible. You have green wrinkled possible. And notice that those are like one parent or the other, exactly. So those offspring are called parental types. because they are just like one parent or the other. But you also have possible smooth wrinkled, yellow wrinkled and smooth green, which isn't like either parent originally. And so those kinds are called recombinant individuals because the genes have been recombined. So you have parental types and recombinant types. Recombinant types aren't like either of the original parents. And all four are shown here, but notice because of the way the Punnett square works and because of the way dominance works over recessivity, it's not a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio of these four. Instead, it's a 9-to-3-to-3-to-1 ratio. Only one of these 16 is going to give you recessive trait for both characteristics. In other words, green and wrinkled. Three of them give you the recessive in one but dominant in the other. That would be three that are green and smooth, three that are yellow and wrinkled. Most of them, 9 of the 16, are going to give you dominant trait in both characteristics, both yellow and round. Okay, so 9, just like 3-to-1 is an important ratio in the F2 if we're talking about a monohybrid cross, 9-to-3 to 3-to-1 is an important ratio for the F2 in a dihybrid cross. Yeah. The recombinants would be all three, these middle two, sorry. See, this one is just like one of the original parents. This one is just like one of the original parents. These two aren't. Okay. Oh, sorry. 9-to-3 to 3-to-1. And if you would think about that in terms of their phenotypes, it would be 9 dominant-dominant to 3 dominant-recessive to 3 recessive-dominant to 1 recessive-recessive.
And that's always, that ratio is always true.
If you have complete dominance in both genes, it's true for any dihybrid cross, regardless of what the characteristics are. All right, slide 11 is another Punnett square, but this is using pennies just to show you that really this is just a probability exercise. And so getting one type of gamete or the other is really just like flipping a coin. Because when you choose a Y here, like I was talking about, you have a 50% chance of choosing this Y, a 50% chance of choosing this Y. So making gametes is really just like flipping coins, and it can be represented that way. A head or a tail is just like a dominant or a recessive, respectively. And getting both of them together is really like flipping two coins or flipping the same coin twice. Well, the odds of getting two heads if you flip a coin twice is 1/2 times 1/2, which is 1/4. Right? So this is where these fractions correspond to the phenotypic ratios. Right? Okay, no new information there, really. The rest of this slideshow is about what are called exceptions or extensions to Mendelian genetics. Remember I said that there are two requirements for genes to behave in a Mendelian fashion? Who can tell me what the requirements are?
They must have complete dominance.
Yes, complete dominance. Right, exactly. The gene that you're studying has to have exactly two alleles, not more than two alleles. So another way of saying that is the characteristic you're studying has to have exactly two traits possible. Right? Well, if either or both of those assumptions is violated, then you no longer have a Mendelian gene. You still have a gene, but it gives you different kinds of results. So the Punnett squares are a little different. And I just wanted to talk about a few of these. The one that's shown in slide 12 is called incomplete dominance. So the name right away tells you that it must be an exception to the rule because one of the rules is complete dominance. Incomplete is not complete, obviously. When you have a gene that works by incomplete dominance, it means that there still is dominance. So one of the two alleles dominates over the other one. But it's no longer true that just one dominant allele is enough to give you the full dominant phenotype. Okay? One dominant allele will give you that dominant phenotype, but not to as much a degree as having two dominant alleles. And therefore, in this example of red flowers and white flowers, red is dominant over white, but if you're only fully red flower if your genotype is upper R, upper R. In other words, if you're homozygous dominant. If you made a homozygous dominant with a homozygous recessive, you of course get a heterozygous individual, just like always. Because one flower is going to give you one gamete is going to have an uppercase R, one gamete is going to have a lowercase R. So they're all going to be uppercase R, lowercase R, but this is a different kind of symbol. Don't worry about that. It's R and W, meaning red and white here. The point is, if you only have one red allele, it only makes you somewhat red, not fully red, and therefore you're pink instead of fully red. That's incomplete dominance. But still, the only way you can be white is to be homozygous recessive. Yeah. It's incomplete dominance, and there, in incomplete dominance, there's three phenotypes possible. When you have complete dominance, there was only two phenotypes possible, right? Purple and white in the flower example. Well, if you have incomplete dominance, a heterozygous individual, that genotype corresponds to a different phenotype compared to the homozygous dominant. So there's three possible phenotypes. And just like you had a 1-to-2-to-1 ratio for genotypes before that I was talking about, well, you have a 1-to-2-to-1 phenotypic ratio when you have incomplete dominance. Because two of these possibilities gives you pink. Only one gives you red, only one gives you white. Okay. Slide 13 is actually two examples of other exceptions to Mendelian genetics. Let me just tell you what the exceptions are first. One is that it's codominance, and the other one is multiple alleles. Okay, let's talk about multiple alleles first. The reason that, multiple alleles means more than two alleles for whatever gene you're studying. Yeah, thanks. So remember, for it to be Mendelian, there has to be exactly two alleles. Well, anything more than that is called multiple alleles. And a good example of that is shown here with the ABO blood group in humans. There's all kinds of blood groups that humans use, but there's only two that are really of clinical significance, because those are the ones that can kill you if you get the wrong blood. And one of those is the ABO blood group. It's called that because there's three different alleles for the gene that determines your blood type. There's an A-type allele, a B-type allele, and an O-type allele. Right? Multiple alleles. But an individual still only has two alleles because you have two chromosomes, one from your father, one from your mother. So that means there's more possibilities here. You could get both of them be the A type, or you could get one A and one O. A is dominant over O, so in either of those cases, you are a type A person. You could get both of them being B, or you could get a B and an O from your parents. Since B is also dominant over O, that would make you type B. Or you could get an A and a B, and that would make you type AB. Or you could get both of them type O. Those are the six possibilities. So it gets more complicated, right? With multiple alleles, and therefore you don't have those same kind of ratios. So that's why it's called multiple alleles. But the reason that it's also an exception for a different reason called codominance is that A is not dominant over B and B is not dominant over A. They're both individually dominant over O. But A and B are codominant, meaning that they both will create the phenotype separately and simultaneously. In the blood example, what that means is that a person that is type AB is just as much type A as a fully type A person is, but at the same time, that person is just as type B as a fully type B person. So they have both traits at the same time. That's codominance. And that's, notice that's different from incomplete dominance. Don't get those two confused. Okay? That's two separate exceptions to Mendelian inheritance. By the way, the reason that this is clinically important is because the genes here, the alleles, A, B, and O alleles, those code for proteins like genes do in general. And the proteins are put onto the surface of the red blood cells. Those proteins are called antigens. Antigens are particles that can be recognized by an animal's immune system. And the things that recognize antigens are proteins of a different kind, proteins that are called antibodies. Okay? Well, your blood type tells you what kind of antigens that are going to be on the surface of your red blood cells. Whole blood, though, is more than just cells. Whole blood contains the cells and what else? The plasma. And the plasma has a bunch of proteins in it of different types, but including antibodies. Now, a person that has type A blood has type A antigens on its red blood cells. Therefore, the plasma of that person will not have anti-A antibodies, because that person does not want to recognize its own antigens as foreign invaders. Otherwise, that person's blood will attack its own blood. So a person with type A blood will have A antigens, but anti-B antibodies. In other words, antibodies that will recognize B antigens, because it'll recognize them as foreigners. Conversely, a type B person will have B antigens, but anti-A antibodies. Okay? Well, if you're type AB person, you have both types of antigens, and therefore you better not have either kind of antibody. And if you're a type O person, you don't have either kind of antigen, so you have both types of antibodies to recognize any of the others as foreigners. If you're a type O person, they're called the universal donor of red blood cells only, though, importantly. That's why they spin whole blood down and separate the plasma from the blood cells. But if you give just the type O cells to a person, it doesn't matter what their type is, because they don't have anything that the antibodies can recognize. So they're safe. No matter what kind of antibodies the recipient person has, O cells will be safe. But you wouldn't want to give the plasma from a type O person to anyone else other than a type O person, because it has anti-A and anti-B antibodies that will attack any kinds of blood that the recipient has already. Okay, so that it's the universal donor of just the cells. AB is called the universal recipient of cells. They can receive blood from anyone because they don't have either kind of antibody. They have both antigens, and they don't care what kind of antigens come in on the cells, right? But you have to be careful with mismatches, because if you give type B blood to a type A blood person, the anti-B antibodies in a type A person will attack the B blood that you give it. Okay, that's why. All right, slide 14 is another exception. This exception is called epistasis. And epistasis is gene interaction. What I mean by that is that the operation of one gene affects the operation of another gene. And the example I'm using here is coat color, fur color in rats. There's two different genes involved here. You have to have two genes to have gene interaction, right? Two different genes involved, although we're only talking about one characteristic. The characteristic is coat color. And notice that there's three possible phenotypes, three traits. Black, brown, and white. The reason that it's gene interaction or epistasis is that there is one gene that codes for the protein that actually is the pigment. It's the stuff that actually gives the color. And there's two different alleles for that. So there's two different colored pigments, black and brown. Okay? But there's another gene that makes a protein that's not a pigment. It's a protein that kind of operates as a switch to turn either off or on the other gene that actually produces the pigment. Okay? And so there's two possibilities for that gene. That's the C gene, by the way. The C gene is the one that produces a protein that controls the B gene. And if you have the dominant version of that C gene, it will turn on the B gene. If you have the recessive version, it will turn off the B gene. So, if you are homozygous recessive for C, meaning that you have both lowercase c's, the B gene will stay off. And therefore, it doesn't matter what B's you have, you'll not actually go through with making the color. The B's determine what color you would make. But that B gene is only going to work if you have at least one uppercase C in the other gene. And that's why the only ones here that are white are the ones that have two lowercase C's. And in that case, it doesn't matter at all what the B's are. Because without an uppercase C, you can't actually make the pigment. On all the other ones, you have at least one uppercase C. So that means the B gene is turned on by the C gene. And then it does matter what the B gene combination is to determine what color is actually deposited. If you have at least one uppercase B, which stands for black, then the rat is black. If you have both lowercase B's, then you're brown instead. Okay? So you have one gene controlling another one. That's epistasis, which is not Mendelian. That's an exception to Mendelian genetics. And this next one, slide 15, is another exception using human skin color as an example. And this exception is called polygenic inheritance. Polygenic just means involving many genes. Poly means many. Genic is the adjective of gene. So with polygenic inheritance, one characteristic, which in this case is skin color, is being controlled by multiple genes. In the simple Mendelian case that we started with last time, each characteristic was controlled by its own single gene, right? There's a flower color gene, there's a flower placement gene, there's a seed shape gene. They all correspond to just one characteristic. Here you have one characteristic being controlled by several different genes at once. And therefore, with several different genes, each of which have two possible alleles, at least, maybe even more, then there are a lot of different combinations. And that's exactly why with polygenic inheritance, you have very, very many different phenotypes, different traits within that characteristic, that vary from one extreme to another in a gradual way along a continuum. So there's very dark skin, there's very light skin, and there's everything in between. because there's so many combinations when you involve multiple genes. Okay? These little circles in here, by the way, represent genes. So they're saying there are 6 genes involved here, and each gene can be either the black or the white version. So the higher the percentage of whites you have, the lighter skinned overall, the higher percentage of black ones you have, the darker skinned overall, but there's a lot of combinations. And I think slide 16 is the last slide. This just shows you a couple tests that can be done to test for the genetics of a fetus before it's born, which would be useful if you happen to know your own genetics as parents, and you know that you're both carriers for a genetic disorder. That means that you don't have the disorder yourself because you only have one of those mutant alleles. You still have one normal one, which makes you yourself normal. But if you pass on an abnormal one and your mate passes on the abnormal one, you make an offspring with 2 abnormal ones, which gives you the genetic disorder. You might want to know that information, for instance. So, or for whatever reason. But these are tests, prenatal tests that can be done. And they're called amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling. And they really accomplish exactly the same thing. They allow you to do what is called karyotyping. A karyotype is an arrangement of, it's a pictorial arrangement of the chromosomes so that you can study the genetics. The difference between the two procedures is really when they are done. Notice that the picture on the left shows a much more advanced fetus than the one on the right. So this is later on in pregnancy. Amniocentesis is a procedure that draws fluid called amniotic fluid, which is the fluid that the fetus is bathing in when it's in the uterus during pregnancy. Well, that fluid has some DNA of the fetus in it because it's like a crime scene, basically. Right? The fetus is continuously losing cells from itself into that fluid. Therefore, you withdraw some of that fluid, and then you sample the cells molecularly to look at the genetics. Earlier on, you can do much the same thing, except instead of drawing amniotic fluid, you suck some tissue with a suction tube from what is called a chorionic villus. Villi is just the plural of villus. But a villus in general is like a finger-like projection. So all these things hanging off of this red layer, which is called the chorion, are called chorionic villi. And they also contain fetal DNA. So it's just 2 different ways of obtaining fetal DNA at 2 different times during pregnancy. But they end up giving you same exact results. And that's it. So how far are your, where are your blue lines?
About halfway.
They're about halfway? Okay, then we'll go, let's go at least 10 more minutes. Why don't we crank them up to 150 and go 10 more minutes.